This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on January 16th, 2014. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Well, I want to welcome everyone to this, the first public meeting of the Federal Election Commission for 2014, an election year. Without objection, I want to take just a moment of personal privilege. And I just want to say that 2014 promises to be an exciting year. It is an election year. The election's fast approaching, and we have several important priorities ahead of us in 2014. Among the priorities that we intend to address, we are working on a new information technology system to improve the functionality and security of the information technology system here at the FEC. And although he can't be with us here today because he's preparing for other things, I want to thank Mr. Palmer for leading that effort. At the core of our mission is the collection of voluminous amounts of campaign finance data and dissemination of that data to the public. And we are committed to fulfilling that mission effectively. As a corollary to the improvement of our IT system, Vice Chair Ravel and I have launched an initiative at the here at the Commission to improve the data dissemination on our website. This will be probably a take over a year to do, and we intend to involve the public in that process by taking in public comment so that the public can tell us how they want to be presented the data that we collect. And Vice Chair Ravel will take this gavel next year and see that effort to a conclusion. We have challenges inside the building, and we want to take care of those. The most important will be the rebuilding of our reports analysis division and the clearing up of a backlog of reporting pages, and so that we can fulfill our mission to provide the regulated community and the committees who come before us timely reaction to the reports that they file, so that problems embedded in their reports do not compound themselves over time. We also want to continue to prod and shape the mission of our reports analysis division to put compliance and advice to the regulated treasurers who come before them to be as important as finding errors in their reports after the fact. So we're going to continue to build on the mission of the reports analysis division. We're going to continue and redouble our efforts to emphasize compliance. Compliance seminars and conferences and webinars to help the regulated community and the citizens who come before us comply with the law. There was some press here today. I would ask for your assistance in doing that. We have an upcoming conference in Tampa, Florida on February 11 and 12. To the extent you can include any comment about that upcoming conference in your press reports, that would be helpful to us. Along those lines, a refrain in all comments I'll be making, the FEC has a very helpful and hidden gem in this building. It's called the Helpline. When I was on private practice, I used it quite often. So one refrain, I'll maybe sound a little bit like Jerry Brown in his last presidential run, 1-800-424-9530. And I encourage all citizens to make use of that helpline, because there's some experts in this building, and they will share their expertise with you if you call that line. Looking ahead, we have challenges as a commission to clarify our rules, to update our regulations and our reporting forms, and to make our enforcement procedures as fair as possible to the good citizens whose democratic activities come before us. And as the election season progresses, I expect we'll see an increasing number of requests for legal guidance of the commission in the form of advisory opinions, and we will endeavor to provide clear and prompt responses to those requests. Our overriding goal here, as I see it, must be to avoid the deterrence of the exercise of First Amendment rights and to encourage the exercise of those profoundly important rights by American citizens. Another important priority that I want to emphasize today as I take the gavel is our agency's commitment and my personal commitment to the principles of fairness, equality, and fundamental human decency in our workplace. So today I am reaffirming those principles by signing the 2014 FEC policy statement on non-discrimination and equal employment opportunity, which reminds all of us here of our obligations to each other, to treat each other with mutual respect and a sense of humanity. When we walk in the door each day, we should all feel confident that our work will be judged on its merits and on our efforts, and that we will work in a hospitable place free of discrimination. This is important not just because it is the legal thing to do, but because it is the right thing to do. I will ask Kevin Sally, who heads our office that protects these important American values, to disseminate this statement on non-discrimination to all FEC employees and contractors. And I will ask our secretary to include a copy of the text of this statement in the minutes of this meeting. As we consider the decency we owe each other, it bears noting that we lost one of our colleagues to illness last week. Tyvese Holmes. Tyvese processed disclosure filings in our information division downstairs, and she served at this commission for over 22 years. I met Tyvese, and I can tell you she was an expert in the work that she did and very committed to it. She came to work on a Friday, and early the next week she was no longer with us. And so it reminds all of us to treat each other with respect and decency while we're here. So let's commit ourselves to working together collegially in service to the American people and in service to their exercise of First Amendment rights, as well as their right to a clean, democratic process. I look forward to working with Vice Chair Ravel this year and my fellow commissioners and the dedicated and experienced staff of the FEC to meet these important objectives. Thank you. Mr. Sally, I'm going to sign this. Federal Election Commission Policy Statement on Non-Discrimination and Equal Employment Opportunity. I'll ask you to take it, and I want to thank you for the good work you and your office do on behalf of the good people here. Thank you, sir. Proceeding to the agenda, Vice Chair, do we have any motions for late arriving documents?
I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda item 14-7, Notice of Interpretive Rule on Reporting Nationwide Independent Expenditures in Presidential Primary Elections, Drafts A, B, and C, and Agenda Item 14-8, Meeting Dates for the Months of February through September 2014.
Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. No opposed. Record reflect it was a unanimous vote, 6-0. Okay, the first item on today's agenda is the approval of the minutes for December 3rd and 5th, 2013. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I do. I move to adopt agenda document numbers 14-1 and 14-2. Minutes for the open sessions held on December 5th, 2013, and December 17th, 2013.
Pardon me. I believe the correct number is 14-1-A and 14-2-A.
Mistakes already.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
The motion is so amended. All those in, is there any comment?
Aye.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion passes 6-0. Okay, the next item on the agenda is the discussion of draft advisory opinion 2013-18, Revolution Messaging, LLC. I understand we have a presentation by Mr. Theo Lutz of our Office of General Counsel and Bob Knopp as well. Gentlemen, thank you. And I'd also like to invite to the table, we have Joe Sandler of Sandler, Reef & Young. Mr. Sandler, if you come forward, please. We also have Charles Keegan and Scott Goodstein, who I understand are with Revolution Messaging, the requester. If you'd come forward, please. And I understand you all will be available to answer any questions that the commission may have of you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Lutz.
Thank you, Chairman Goodman, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 13-50 contains two draft responses to an advisory opinion request by Revolution Messaging. Revolution Messaging proposes to place banner ads in smartphone apps and on mobile formatted websites on behalf of its clients, that is, political committees and persons making independent expenditures. Revolution Messaging asks whether the ads are exempt from the Act's disclaimer requirements under either the small items or impracticable exception. Draft A concludes that no, the proposed banner ads are not exempt from the Act's disclaimer requirements, but that Revolution Messaging could satisfy those requirements through alternative means. Draft B concludes the proposed ads qualify for the small items exception and thus do not require disclaimers. The Commission received one comment on the request and two comments on the drafts. Additionally, if the Commission approves a response, we request authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Okay. Anybody have any comments or questions? Anybody would like to be recognized? Did you?
No, I was going to.
Oh, Commissioner Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Want to start by asking a question of requester's counsel or Mr. Goodstein or. I think it would be helpful to begin this discussion by getting a little bit more detail, maybe an overview of the nature of these mobile banner ads. And there's some terms that are in there that for non-techies like me, I'm not as familiar with static interstitial ads, rich media expandable ads, and some of the differences between these different types of advertising mediums, and also about the competing advantages, why certain types are more popular or more common. I was just wondering if we could just, I know for me, and there probably are others up here on the dais who could use a little bit more of a background about these different types of ads before we start getting kind of into more of the meat of the legal analysis here.
Again, Mr. Commissioner, thank you for your time. Sure. My name is Keegan Gudis with Revolution Messaging. Thank you, everybody, for having us. To address your question, there are a wide variety of ways you can advertise on a mobile phone. And what the sizes that we're looking for the commission to address are the smallest ones, really, that show on a mobile phone. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to
sure.
show you my phone here just to give you an example of the size would be at the top here. It's about that size right here at the top, generally.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the type of phone, it scales differently. And then like an interstitial to what you referred to is something that really takes up almost the entire screen and shows up when you're going and reading another piece of content or after you finish playing a game on Words with Friends. There's a wide variety. The two sizes really in question here are the 320 by 50 and the 300 by 50. The 320 by 50 makes up 53% of total mobile ad spending, is the most popular unit because of the size of these screens and how well it fits. Also, those that use that mobile ad size are able to target much more locally. They're much more prevalent, and mobile websites and mobile apps allow for advertisers to target down to like a city block, and allows for campaign committees to spend a very small amount of money to get their message heard. For the static banner, yeah.
Okay, and so so in that case, and that's something that, so banner ads provide that sort of a kind of precision targeting that, again, if I screw up the usage of the terms, please correct me, but the static interstitial and rich media don't allow that sort of targeting, right, like the banner ads do. And is it also the case that there are, oh.
One other thing on that is that you're talking about huge expensive differences. A regular campaign, a local congressional race can go and buy the 320 by 50 and can create that very easily and very rapidly. When you're starting to talk about any type of rollover, rich media, interstitial, right? There's expandable. There's real technology involved in it that's not available universally today or even in the very near future, where these other banners that Keegan was talking about, my colleague was talking about, are pretty much the universal. They take up, like you were saying, about a small 1/3 of your screen. They're not intrusive to app developers to making games.
Okay. And just following up on that, is it the case that there are many mobile websites and many apps that permit banner ads, but that don't, for one reason or another, even allow these static interstitial rich media formats to be present on their websites and on their apps?
That is correct, because they feel that their users of their apps are visiting and reading their content don't want to be seeing ads that take up so much space. They feel that they're intrusive to their experience.
Okay. So the decision that we could make today, there may be several websites that you would like to advertise on, or maybe an app that you would like to put a banner ad on, that even... that if we were to say that you, the commission were to decide that you had to have a disclaimer on whatever mobile ads you had, that would in essence eliminate a wide range of websites and apps on which you could run ads because of if we were to impose a disclaimer requirement on.
Yeah,
on your ads.
That is correct, and it also doesn't allow for campaigns to take advantage of really what we consider cutting-edge technology in mobile advertising.
Okay. One of the comments that that were in your follow-ups to the drafts, Mr. Sandler, said that banner ads, quote, work best with how a mobile phone displays digital content, and it sounds like... the reason why banner ads work well is it less expensive. They don't crowd out other content. That sounds like that's a consideration that's often made with respect to mobile website developers and apps, app developers, that these other types of ads really, kind of take up the whole screen, and there are some sites that don't want their users don't like that sort of experience. Is that
accurate? It's also because it's so popular. I mean, we're looking for a way for a hypothetical campaign committee, Linda Smith for Congress. We want Linda Smith's campaign committee to be able to take advantage of what is the most popular unit that allows for the most flexibility, and as my colleague Scott mentioned, has the ability to turn around quickly. A lot of these other things take time to build, or as you mentioned, sites don't offer them.
Okay. I guess I'll direct this to Mr. Sandler. As I was thinking about this, it seems like in this way, these banner ads, in a way, can be likened to bumper stickers and to buttons, in the sense that the reason why bumper stickers are a certain size is because they fit the size of a bumper. The technology is in place where you could print bigger bumper stickers that would allow for a disclaimer, but then it wouldn't be that compatible with how the size of a bumper. And the same thing with buttons. You could mandate that there be disclaimers on buttons, but they would be of a size that would not be conveniently worn on a person's apparel. And so similarly, it sounds like banner ads, the reason why that they're the preferable means is that they're the most, at this point at least, most compatible with the experience that people have vis-a-vis their mobile phone. Is that?
Yes, that's exactly right, Commissioner. The fact is that in applying this small items exemption, the commission has focused on the specific format that an advertiser proposes to use or does use, even though a different format in that same medium, say larger buttons. We all see people at the political conventions wearing these giant oversized buttons that easily accommodate a disclaimer. That's never led, and I don't believe would lead the commission to conclude, therefore, the small exemption, the exception doesn't apply to buttons on which a disclaimer cannot be printed in the language of the regulation.
In this case, just to my own way of thinking, it seems like an even more compelling factor for allowing banner ads to avail themselves of the small items exception is, unlike buttons or bumper stickers, the size of which are governed purely by market forces. Here we have the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which sets standards. I don't know how mandatory those are, but those kind of govern the field, it sounds like. And so that's an external body that has an impact on what the size of these banner ads are allowed to be.
You want to talk about, that's right. Their standard, we're talking about, when you talk about the formats that are offered as, quotes, options by Draft A, we're really talking about not different medium, but different formats that are recognized by the Bureau as essentially a completely different advertising format: the rich banner and static interstitial.
Okay, and just if I could ask one last question, do you think that the logic of Draft A undercuts the rationale of applying the small items exception to items that are already traditionally covered, such as buttons, bumper stickers, and pens and pencils?
Yes, for exactly the reasons we indicated. The same logic would indicate that and it is the case that buttons, pens, bumper stickers are available, can be ordered in sizes sufficient to accommodate a disclaimer, if that meant that when a campaign political committee chooses to order it in a standard size that doesn't accommodate it, that the exemption doesn't apply. And that's not how the commission has interpreted. That's clearly not the logic or intent of the regulation.
All right. Thank you.
Any comments or questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got a whole new perspective down here. I view this, it's our job to start with the statute. We have to start with the statutory obligation, which is to provide consumers, viewers, recipients of information with information about who is providing them with that information. I think the disclaimer and the disclosure requirements of the Act have been, they've been upheld by every court that's ever looked at them. The Supreme Court most recently has fairly ringingly endorsed the importance of people knowing where the message is coming from. In the early days of the Act, the Commission sort of sua sponte created this small items exception. There's not a lot of legislative history on where it came from, but it seems to me to have been an attempt to accommodate traditional forms of campaign paraphernalia that are used for grassroots organizing purposes. One thing about a bumper sticker or a T-shirt or a button is it doesn't accomplish anything unless somebody, some individual, decides they're going to put that bumper sticker on their car, they're going to wear that T-shirt, they're going to put that button on. It becomes very much a method of self-expression. And it's a way for people, I know I always look around when I'm driving down the streets during an election year and I see what bumper stickers are on the car, and it's a pretty good indication of who your friends and neighbors are, at least in your own community, are planning on voting for. The commission has had to deal in various instances with, I suppose you could call it new technology, helicopter ads that are being spoken by the weather people when they're going around in the helicopters, in the Metro Networks case, and in the Club for Growth AO, we had a request that, you know, gee, we're really going to be have a hard time complying with the requirements because we only want to do a 15-second ad, and it's not going to give us enough time. And the commission said the law requires you to have this disclaimer, and it's not you can't just say, well, I choose to have a smaller amount of time, and I don't want to waste any of my time on the disclaimer. It's not really an option. The only time that the commission has ever extended the small items exemption to mass communication is the Target Wireless AO. That was so long ago, as before I got here. And that was a time when we had, I meant to look through my old drawers. I bet I still have one of those old flip phones around with the itty-bitty screens that people were using in the day in 2002 when the Target Wireless, I mean, the very name of the company, Wireless, sounds a little bit quaint at this point in time. Oh, somebody found me an old flip phone. Cool. Yeah, it's a much smaller screen than what I've got now. I hope this isn't actually somebody's phone that they're still using. That's somebody who's very helpful to me ought to be embarrassed that they're still carrying around a phone like this. But you know, the technology has moved a lot since 2002, and the Target Wireless AO, I'm not even sure that's still good law. There are probably a lot of people out there who advise their clients, well, the commission issued this blanket exemption for text messaging. But in fact, like all AOs, that was predicated on the facts that were before the commission, which included a hard and fast 160-character limit on what you could put in a text. I've had some fairly extensive text conversations with my daughters, I know, and I'm pretty sure we went over that 160-character limit and we sent pictures back and forth. The technology has really moved since then, and the assumptions that that underlay that opinion are really no longer true about the limits of that technology. And that's always true of technology. Technology is always on the move. And I think it's very dangerous for the commission to look at it at one particular static point in time and say, well, as of today, this technology seems to have one capability and not another one. Therefore, we're going to carve out an exemption from the statute that we are obligated to administer and enforce. I think I view technology as an opportunity, not an obstacle. It's not something that stands in the way of greater disclosure and greater information dissemination and greater transparency, but something that really facilitates that. But I think if we were to say today that anytime you want to put in start shooting out these ads to people's phones, information that comes to them, it's not volitional like taking a T-shirt and putting it on, but rather information that you are the passive recipient of, and say, and those folks don't have to provide any mechanism at all for telling you who's providing that message to you, I think that would be a mistake and it would be premature. I have more faith in the technology developing in a way that will help people get all of the information that they need, both the message and the source. And I think that the commission has been flexible in the past in how that information can be delivered. It doesn't necessarily mean that the banner ad itself has to contain every single word of a traditional disclaimer. I think if there are links, if there are rollovers, if there are pop-ups, if there are any other form of that technology has to offer that can provide people who are getting a message with the means of determining who's sending that message, then all of those are opportunities to explore, and I would be willing to be very flexible in terms of how that information gets conveyed, but I'm not willing to say that we're just going to carve out an exemption for an increasingly important method of disseminating campaign messaging over people's cell phones and say, you know, in that entire realm of technology, we're just not going to have any disclaimers. I think that would be a mistake.
Commissioner Hunter.
I'd just like to hear if Mr. Sandler or his colleagues have any comment to what Commissioner Weintraub said.
Yes, I just a couple of quick responses. The disclaimer requirements as opposed to the reporting disclosure requirements have not been tested or upheld by the courts. That's a different issue. The small exemption, the small items exemption, I think you'll find goes back actually to 1971. And Congress chose to not to change it in adopting the amendments to the act in 1974. They didn't change it in the McCain-Feingold in 2002. It doesn't, I don't think there's any real issue that you could say that there's any effort here to defeat the statutory intent by applying the small items exemption, you know, by its own logic that's been around for 35, 40 years now. And that's really all we're asking for now. We're not trying to create some kind of a blanket exemption to disclosure. All these expenditures that we're talking about would be either political committee expenditures that are disclosed. The expenditure would be disclosed to Revolution Messaging would be disclosed if it's an independent expenditure. It would be disclosed. The issue about what else gets disclosed besides the expenditure and donors and dark money, all that is not implicated in any way in this request.
I agree with that, if I may. I agree with that last statement that all of that is not implicated here, but I think what is implicated is whether people are going to know who's sending the messages on their phones, and I think that's an important issue.
If I could, Commissioner Hunter, thank you for the opportunity to address this. Commissioner Weintraub, you even started with sort of laughing about the joke of these old phones, from my perspective, I'm not my attorney. I don't know the legal requirements around this. But I can tell you, Commissioner, that my first jobs on campaigns, like many people that face before this commission, were going around college dormitories and putting bumper stickers up on other people's doors, right?
Shame on you.
And, yeah, there's a little hard to peel off. I understand. but none of those, we weren't breaking rules of campaign finance disclosure around doing that. We were just communicating our message. And to me, this is no different than standing on a soapbox or handing out a button or a bumper sticker. We now have laughed about how much the phones have advanced. Unfortunately, the text message still has not, the amount of data that you can put back and forth to the tower is only 160 characters. The smarter phones are looping that together. But that, what was the company?
Target
Wireless was actually the technology. Today's technology and communication, more and more, I agree with you, Commissioner, is going towards mobile phone. If you look at how much traffic is even going to the FEC's website, it's probably coming in more and more from mobile phones. And what we're saying is that public square, we should be able to go and put a bumper sticker on. I don't think in the size of a very, very small banner ad, we're doing major convincing of the campaign. I think we're doing the exact same thing as a bumper sticker or a pin or a button in communication. And the campaign should still be required to do full disclosures that they're spending money with firms like Revolution Messaging. And ultimately, I do think that the technology is not there for pop-ups and rollovers and all these other things that you talk about. You're putting huge limits on campaigns financially, technologically, and also they can't service their ads in that community. The technology to do a banner and put that banner everywhere is there. The technology to do some type of rollover made out of flash technology works on a computer. And it was mentioned in Disclosure A, but that's not actually there today. So we're talking about technology that doesn't exist on mobile phones, or at the very least exists in very, very high-end, universal, $50,000, $100,000 mobile ad buys.
Well, it certainly exists in the link context, because there's an entire social medium, Twitter, that's based on sending very short messages with very few characters, but with embedded links that take you to more detailed messages. I don't know what the percentage is, but it seems to me that most of the tweets that I read have little links embedded in them that take you somewhere else where you can get more information. That's another, that exists, and that's another alternative way of doing it. My concern is that if we just say at the get-go, oh, this is small, and therefore people don't have to provide the disclaimer, then that no one's ever going to try, because we'll have just carved out that exemption at the beginning, and we actually will be blocking the development of new ways of providing information to people. When you stand up on a soapbox, I can see who you are. I know who's telling me that message. You know, notwithstanding that you may have put bumper stickers on other people's doors without their permission, most bumper stickers are voluntarily put on people's own cars by themselves because they want to convey that message. And when I see my neighbors driving around in their cars, I know who they are. And I know who the people are who are wearing the T-shirts that are endorsing particular candidates. But the electronic communications provide for the opportunity for a lot more opacity, shall we say, about who the source of the message is. And when I get information on my phone, I want to know where it's coming from. Seems to me that I'm constantly inadvertently going to different websites just by swiping on the ad without even intending to, and then all of a sudden I'm launched into another website and I've got all this information that I never wanted to have in the first place. So I just have a hard time believing that the technology isn't there to send people to a place where they can get this information if they want it.
Vice Chair Rabin.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming before us with this issue, because it's really a very significant issue. As you yourself said, and I think Commissioner Weintraub has indicated, more and more people are accessing political information today on their cell phones. It is a hugely important source of political information, and in the 2012 election, the Pew Center said there was something like 35% of people who used their cell phones to access political information and advertisements as well. And given the fact that the increased uses of smartphones and the availability of smartphones is so much is proliferating, this is going to be the wave of the future. This is going to be the place where everybody is getting their political information. And you talk about ads. I mean, just as an aside, most people don't like ads at all. So, you know, that's not an argument for this, actually, when they're playing a game or doing something else. But it is precisely because of the importance of the use of smartphones, I think, in politics and political campaigns, that we have to be really, really careful that we ensure that the essential protections that are there for the voters that are contained in those disclaimer requirements aren't eviscerated because of an argument that it cannot be placed on the ad, banner ad itself. And there are, in fact, ways, as has been discussed already, to link or to access information in other ways, and also things that could be developed ultimately to do that. And, I know I've already been here 3 months, so I'm going to stop talking about California at the next meeting. But, but you know, California in 2011, I believe it was, working with the industry, adopted regulations with respect to these very same issues. And the industry complies with those regulations, has never complained about them, and it has not created a problem in one of the largest states in the union with a very active political environment. So I can't imagine that this same exact situation could occur on the federal level and would not be problematic for the companies to comply by either rollover ads, hover ads, or links, or whatever it is that is necessary in order to comply. And I just believe that given the huge significance of not only permitting political speech, but also complying fully with our disclaimer requirements because of the proliferation of this speech and the importance for people to be able to get the important information about who's behind those ads, I think that A is clearly the appropriate way to go in this.
Just once again, I'd like to hear from the council on the comment, particularly on the California regulations.
Do you want to go to California first? Yeah. I'm sorry, what? Yeah. Yeah, I don't think the what happened with the California ruling is a universal solution in this case. That is, I'll let our attorney talk a little bit more about the legality around that. I would like to address, and I'd be curious if any commissioner can outline a scenario that they fear where this would be misused, because I just want to make sure that all of you understand that the only scenario where this is going to happen, where we're not linking to somewhere where we can have a disclaimer, is working with, I'm going to go back to the same hypothetical campaign, James Smith for Congress doesn't have money or time to build out a precinct voting location tool that can have her disclaimer on that. So she uses mobile ads to link to a state board of elections site where people who are seeing a banner that says "Vote Jane Smith November 5th" can click on that and go and look at their polling location. That's really what we're trying to do here, is to make it easier for smaller campaigns who don't have the money possible to meet the requirements as we understand them now, to make use of this technology. There, that's basically what's happening here.
And that's an important point. In the majority, probably the vast majority of cases, the advertiser will choose to put a link on because they want to sign somebody up or get them to donate whatever. But there's a number of cases where the link's going to be to somebody else's website because they want other information. And basically, the issue is, you're going to preclude them from doing that, even though the commission's regulations on their face permit it.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And those were very nice comments at the beginning of the meeting, by the way, so I look forward to helping you accomplish that. I guess the concern I have is the main reason we're here anymore is a disclosure. And that is, of course, when I grew up and saw everything that was taking place in Watergate, I was glued to the black and white television, and not exactly, but it was really something that became so important to us in the democratic system. We're here to make sure that people know where money goes, inside and out, who's spending it, who's providing it. And I think if we ever, and my votes pretty much show that, when that starts to erode, it becomes more difficult for me to support that. And I think here, I'm concerned about the movement toward technology right now, to the point where these kind of messages technologically are going to be coming at us in so many different ways that, for example, my son, emailed him something the other day, and I told him I emailed him, and he says, "Dad, I don't use email anymore." He's using cell phone, he's texting, and he's readying and, whatever else those kids do, but it's just not there anymore. So I'm behind even that generation. And so now, since he doesn't have email and doesn't pack, doesn't look at that, he wanted for Christmas a Pebble Watch. And a Pebble Watch is a watch where you get all your internet on your wrist. It's a little watch. It's also a watch. So he got it, and it's Dick Tracy days. And that way he can't say, "Well, I didn't have my cell phone on" or anything. I can get right to him. So I figured that was a good investment. But the point being that we can't really predict whether it's a Google watches or whatever, or glasses, that's coming at us so fast that I'm concerned about making an exception here, mostly for economic reasons, not so much technical as I understand it, that it'll be hard for us to come back to with the advent of more technology. I did want to ask you this. Are there any campaigns that are using the 322.50 standard? Are there any campaigns that are doing that now?
The 320x50 standard?
The
300x250?
Yeah, 250.
Yeah, quite frequently we use the larger size where possible, and those have disclaimers, as do all of the larger banners. Like if you're using the same technology, works with tablets, and those allow for much larger banners, and those have disclaimers on them.
Uh-huh. It can be done. I mean, it's doable. It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, there's
preferable.
Certain screen limitations with the smaller phones that, I obviously there may be new technological innovations that will change this, but you can't, right now, there's no way to fit a disclaimer in what is the most popular smartphone banner size. All we have space for is a picture of the candidate and, vote November 5th, and there's very little space to do anything, and we use this a lot for our clients for what we call getting out the vote.
That's really the point. There's no certainly, although it's a lot more expensive, it's a lot less common. Yes, there's just situations in which campaigns use it. But this is it's like the commission saying, you want to use a bumper sticker, you can't do that because a disclaimer won't fit on it. Do a poster instead. Do a billboard instead. It's available to you.
Well, thanks for your answers.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There have been some comments about, the dangers that we might encounter if we don't know where the speech is coming from. And I think, as you pointed out, there may be a concern about the disclaimer. I think the issue of disclosure is less, as you pointed out, there are still independent expenditure reporting requirements. These purchases will be on the public record. And I think that whatever dangers that one can imagine, I'm not sure how much danger I think that comes from small banner ads while someone's playing solitaire that may say, vote for Jane Smith, click to find your local polling place. And whatever dangers that presents, I think have to be certainly balanced against the dangers of limiting the ability to speak. And as the chairman eloquently pointed out at the beginning, we administer, enforce, and regulated area of the law that implicates important, indeed essential, First Amendment freedoms. And where we are right now in terms of the technological development with respect to mobile devices is that if we impose this disclaimer requirement on banner ads, we will foreclose the ability of the requester here, and I imagine dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of other similarly situated companies or individuals from speaking through this what is an inexpensive and effective manner of speaking would limit at this particular time a large number of sites and apps on which they could speak, in essence, limit their ability to convey the message. From what I understand, this is particularly effective for smaller committees or smaller outside groups or individuals because they're less expensive. We're basically saying, if you're a richer, more sophisticated operation, you can speak. If you are kind of a smaller grassroots, may not have the financing sources, may not have the technological advancement to purchase or to develop some of these more sophisticated ads, well, good luck. Maybe someday that you'll get the money or you'll get the technological sophistication to catch up. I'm really concerned about if we're going to say that technology may overtake us at some future point, therefore we're going to wait for that day and we're not going to give you this exception, then we're never going to give that exception to anybody because who knows what the future may hold with respect to technology. I think we have to take the world as it is, not as it may be in some future scenario. you know, that's the reason why in 2002 we issued, I wasn't here at the time, but the commission issued the Target wireless. That was the way the world operated at that time. And technology may change things, and the commission may have to adjust its regulatory structure to take into account those at future times. But under the world as we see it right now, I think these banner ads clearly qualify for the small items and exception. And I think that in order to prevent the possibility of substantially limiting the ability of the requester and others like them to speak, I think that is something that should weigh heavily on our minds. I don't know if I saw Mr. Sandler leaning forward towards the microphone at one point, but if there was anything that any point that you would wanted to make. Anyway, but that's my piece on this. I will, for that reason, be happily willing to move and support draft B at the appropriate time, and I don't hold out overt optimism that's going to happen, but we'll see how the votes fall.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one suggestion for you, and I'm not sure how this would pan out, but you have raised the most innocent-sounding use of this technology that you would like to promote. A candidate that doesn't have a lot of resources, that wants to say, vote for me, and link to a government website that would then tell people where to vote. But that's not what you've asked for. You haven't asked for that particular, for an exemption to cover that scenario where presumably the name of the candidate who would be funding the communication would be right in the banner ad. And so there would be a form of identifying where the message is coming from. But what you're asking for is a blanket exemption, which would also allow somebody to parachute into a district from the outside, and somebody who nobody knows who they are, a group that gets set up, I'm sorry, I'm going to raise the dark money specter after all, third-party group that gets set up at the last minute and nobody knows who is behind it, and suddenly they're running banner ads on people's cell phones that say, Congressman Jones is an axe murderer. And nobody knows where it's coming from. Congressman Jones doesn't know where it's coming from, and it's just sort of out of the blue. And because we've issued a blanket exemption for these kinds of banner ads on people's cell phones, there's no way to get at it. And my experience is that once an exemption is granted, it's much harder to narrow it after the fact than to accommodate and interpret and broaden it. So maybe if what you're really concerned about is a candidate who's going to have their own name in the ad that wants to run a banner ad, one of these small banner ads, and the link would be to a government website that would tell people where to vote, I'm willing to consider that one, as long as there's identifying information in the ad that has the candidate's name, which presumably it would, because otherwise it would be a really ineffective ad. But if you're asking for a broader just sort of overall exemption for anybody who uses this kind of banner ad, I'm not willing to go there. So maybe my advice for you is, you want a small items exemption, think small. Ask for something smaller, and that might be a more successful, I don't want to guarantee anything, but I think that might be an easier request to say yes to than an out-and-out, blanket exemption from disclaimer for this, anybody who uses this.
Mr. Sandler, you have a reaction?
Let me see. First of all, when you talk about some of these outside groups that presumably would be required to have the disclaimer because it's qualifies as an independent expenditure, a lot of cases those committee names are misleading, and the disclaimer is not going to communicate much anyway. It's not limited to the government website, although, the possibility of requiring that the candidate's name appear in it. I don't know how that would apply in the case where it's an independent expenditure by a non-political committee. How would you... You want the sponsor identified somehow in the text?
All right. Well, that's not what you were. As I said, you gave the most innocent sounding hypothetical of, well, what we really wanted for is these poor little candidates who are. So now, what are you asking? Who are these groups and what do they want to do?
Well, I mean, they have a wide variety of clients. If it's a you know, a union or an advocacy group that you know, wants to mention that, basically say vote for so and so, and here's where your, you know, your polling place is. I guess, I mean, that would require, you know, they couldn't do that unless they put a disclaimer in, unless there's an exemption, right? Because it's an independent expenditure.
Well, what I'm telling you is that I'm willing to consider, you know, rather than, I'm not willing, certainly not today, and, you know, probably not in response to an AO, to issue sort of a blanket exemption that says any banner ad on a cell phone is going to be exempt from disclosure, from disclaimer requirements. But, you know, if you have the AO, and the AO process wasn't really designed for that. The AO process was designed for, you know, individual transactions. I want to do X. Can I do it? So, you know, yes, I realize this might require more more AOs to be submitted. But if there is, you know, and I'm just sort of, as my kids would say, spitballing here, if there is anything in the ad that would clue people into where it's coming from, you know, Union X says vote Jones. Here's the link for the polling places. I mean, you know, it's anything in the, you know, somewhere in the text. It doesn't have to be. I'm not saying that we would. I would insist on having every single word in a standard disclaimer that you'd get on a letter that you receive in the mail. But something, either in the text of the ad or in a link or something that people could get at that would provide them with information of who is sponsoring the ad. I mean, that's what disclaimers are all about, is telling people who's sponsoring the information.
Can I?
Yes, please.
I just would like to say, and maybe we didn't detail this clearly enough in our advisory opinion request, but so technology we use, this all sinks into advertising exchanges that I believe most of them, I would have to double check, but as far as we understand it, in the technology we work with, they all require what's called brand notification. We can't actually run any type of ad that is masks who is behind it. And this is part of like, this is mainly for private sector, but corporate advertisers, they have to say who their brand is. And everyone we work with, the vendors that are willing to look at previous rulings by the FEC are sometimes willing to not have disclaimers on the smaller banner sizes. You know, some of them say that there has to be a disclaimer on the landing page, so to say. Some of them don't, but all of them uniformly require that there has to be some sort of notification who is actually serving the ad. It actually has to say the candidate's name, has to actually have to say the organization's name. We haven't, you know, that's just an advertising rule in general. So I just wanted to bring that up.
I'm not exactly clear on how this.
I'm saying what your recommendation is, which is I think a very good one, already exists in the advertising world.
Well, are you saying that I'm not clear on how this works though, because are you saying that if say the union wanted to run the ad, that the union's name would have to be somewhere in that banner ad, or is this notification take place? Is it one of these things like the FEC administers, where it's in a closet somewhere, it's publicly available if you go to the particular physical location?
That's how we interpret advertising policies. Yes,
the latter. It's in the closet.
No, the former.
How would it work in this case?
Well, I think maybe. I mean, if it is true, if what I'm hearing is you say is that all of these ads would have within their text some identification of the sponsor. That wasn't part of your request, I think. So maybe what you need to do is give me a little bit more information, you know, maybe revise your request, resubmit the request. And I guess what I'm trying to do is guide what might be influential to me, you know, and it's all about people knowing where it's coming from. And I'm not rigid about how that information gets conveyed, but that, in fact, was what we were trying to convey in draft A, is that it's not a rigid process. We can be flexible about it, but you've got to give us a little bit more information about how that information is conveyed, because I'm afraid that if we just have a blanket exemption, then, you know, nobody's ever going to say where it's coming from, and there is going to be this potential for people coming in from that it won't be clear who's sponsoring the ads.
Well, we'd be happy to provide additional information to that effect, so that opening up the possibility that what's already required, in effect, by industry standards, if that's made a condition of application of the exemption, I think that would probably work for Evolution Messaging.
Because I think, if I may just say one more thing, Mr. Chairman, I think that one of the issues that's raised by this is that when you ask for a categorical exemption like this, it really does, and sometimes that's more appropriate for a rulemaking than for an advisory request. If you ask for something very specific, then that's something that's very conducive to giving you an advisory opinion, because you say, I want to do this very specific thing, and then we can see exactly what it's going to look like. But when you ask for something that is broader and more categorical, it's a little bit harder to see what all of the ramifications are. That's the sort of issue that is often better fleshed out in the rulemaking context. And we could consider doing that. We have in the past considered doing that, in which we would take testimony from all sorts of people and try and come up with a series of rules for different kinds of ads. And, what happens when the candidate is sponsoring the ad, and what happens when an outside group is sponsoring the ad. Maybe the rules would be a little bit different. I don't know if we were to consider that in a rulemaking context. But the touchstone for me is that the recipient of this information can tell where it's coming from.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. I'm guessing Mr. Sandler didn't include that type of information, because I don't believe it's grounded in the regulation anywhere. Maybe I'm forgetting one, but I don't think there's a regulatory framework that says, gee, if there's some indication in the ad of who ran this, therefore you don't need a disclaimer. That's not based in the regulation as far as I can tell. And so that's why Mr. Sandler didn't include that information. I think it's great that we're trying to come up with a way, maybe to allow this client to do this, these banner ads. But, I don't think I need to tell Mr. Sandler either that it looks like this is going to go down 3-3. And so there's not four votes to say you can't do this.
Mr. Weintraub.
We have this discussion all the time. I think there are the reason that people come to us for advisory opinions is not because they're trying to test the waters of whether if somebody files a complaint at the end of a process, there will be four votes to enact a penalty, impose a penalty, but rather how do they comply with the law? And we appreciate that's their goal, and they need four votes to tell them that. That's the way the advisory opinion process works. You need four votes. We have a regulation on the books that talks about small items like pins and bumper stickers, but obviously it's not clear how that applies to cell phone banner ads, which was, not even a technological possibility or in the works in the 1970s when these regulations were put on the books. So, that's our job, is to flesh them out, is to figure out how our regulations apply to new situations. And that's what we're trying to do.
Commissioner Hunter.
Certainly anybody is going to prefer four votes over three. But I do think there are people that are willing to come here and say, well, if I've got 3-3, no one's told us I can't do it. And we've had people appear before us who have said just that. I'm going to keep going on my merry way until there's four votes against me. So I don't think that's necessarily true. And with respect to the advisory opinion process, I disagree with your characterization. People are able, under the law, to come here and ask for questions on how they want to conduct themselves. They have a bunch of different clients. They have a lot of different ways that they want to do this. And so their question, I guess, from your perspective, is quite broad. I think that they're able to do this under the small exemption, and I think they should be free to do so. If people had to wait around for us to do a rulemaking, geez, I mean, they'd never get any guidance on anything. And that's why there's a process here for advisory opinion requests that's a limited amount of time that we have to get back to them.
Well, we used to do rulemakings more quickly.
Commissioner Walter?
I just made a quick comment on this particular matter, though. We do have a statute and regulation that says you can't do it. So, I mean, then you have to decide whether you it fits in a previous decision or not. So I guess all of the lawyers who are in this business recognize that if it's 3-3, that's a partial open door to taking a risk and going ahead to do what we can't at that particular time give a complete answer to, but I just don't think it's always a risk-free to a client to do that.
I just you've obviously brought us an interesting, what I view as really a technological issue. And you've answered this, but just because there's been a lot of discussion, could you go back through, rewind for me for just a minute? Because there's been some discussion about how technology, what this current state of it is, and that it might evolve or develop differently, that there might be other alternatives. Can you just sort of rewind for me? I'm sorry to make you do this. Leading up to the point that whether I'm right in drawing the conclusion that it is not just impractical but virtually impossible to in the pixel space you're at it, to have a electoral message and a disclaimer in this banner ad using this technology.
Yes, this static banner ad, that's the current industry standard. It's most affordable and accessible. If a organization, labor union, wants to say, you know, vote Jones for Congress, find your polling location here, and put a link to the site, it is physically impossible to put on, you know, paid for by International Brotherhood of X, www.xyz, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. That is a physical impossibility. That's what brings us here.
And if you sent the same message to an iPad as opposed to a Droid or an iTouch of this size, do you intend to include the disclaimer on if the pixels accommodate more space and the disclaimer?
We already do, yes.
You do. Yeah. So we're only talking about messages you send that occupy a percentage of the space of this.
Correct.
Okay. I campaign buttons were a technological innovation at one time, too. And at one time, you know, 200 years ago, they were sewn on to sewn on to clothing and shirts. And I doubt that the seamstress could, you know, quite have sewn in a small disclaimer at the bottom. And they evolved over time. They became more ubiquitous. They got easier to print. But they've gone through lithograph and various technologies of printing. And, you know, a typical one is about this size. Kevin, this is yours. It says Trojan Republicans, awesome. But it could say any number. It could say Carter Mondale. I just compared it to the size of my Droid screen. And your ad is smaller than that button, right? And it strikes me that what we're being a little bit stuck in the mud to talk about traditional forms of communication where we have a well-established exemption, and I think what we're really concerned about here is, although I think all of us would admit that the size of this political message is smaller even than the button that we exempt, I think what we're concerned about is the technology makes the communication more effective. It gets out to more people. And I don't think the exemption should turn on the effectiveness of the speech. I think we should embrace the new technology and the ability to push out low-cost, more ubiquitous messages. I'm afraid that we're letting the regulatory tail wag the technological and communication dog here. And it's largely based on this comparison that I believe we should be flexible and extend the small items exemption to a small cell phone screen like this. And that's why I'm prepared to vote for draft B. Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm always glad to see there are Trojans at the table, since we come from a Trojan family also. Although it's true, we don't have a lot of Trojan Republican buttons in our...
I'm a Wahoo, but that's okay.
But the difference between your phone and your button is not just the size, but I don't believe that it's possible to embed a link in your button so when people touch it, then they will be led to an easy source of further information. And even if it were, it might be harassment if people were to walk around and be touching your buttons in order to get more information. So it really is not the same kind of technology at all. It's not just a question of size. It's a question of the capabilities of the technology. And as I said at the beginning, I think there really is a difference. It's not a question of the effectiveness of the communication. It's the T-shirts and bumper stickers and buttons are designed to be distributed so that people can own that message themselves, so they can put it on, literally put the message on them and tell everybody that here I am. Yeah, and here's my political message. And, you know, I don't have Justice Scalia's lovely quote about standing up for your speech, but you scoff at Justice Scalia? But I also think that's important. No, my staff has it for me, of course. Requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. I mean, he has a really serious view of it. But, you know, I don't think we have to doom democracy here, but I do think that the technology offers us opportunities. And as I said at the beginning, we should view it as an opportunity, not an obstacle. And I think there are ways we can do this. But I don't think we have enough information here today to provide comfort to at least some of us that people will know where the message is coming from.
Any other comments? Questions?
Mr. Sandler, would you want to proceed to a vote on this advisory opinion request today, or would you like to take a little more time?
We should take more time to
make our buttons speak.
Mr. Sandler, if you need a little time, we can take a break and you can confer with your clients outside. Why don't we stand in recess for about 5 minutes?
I can summarize right here. It's on their way.
Yeah.
I
turned my lights out.
Are you ready?
Off the races.
Before you dash down, just say. Make sure.
Looks ready.
Okay. Are your colleagues ready?
Put the disclaimer on there.
You ready? You ready?
That comment got submitted.
Okay, we're back in session. Mr. Sandler, when we broke, I think you had the mic and the floor. We could proceed to a vote today. There are other procedural options such as withdrawal and resubmission. We would act promptly, or there's a revision of the current one. I want to know, as a requester, you're our client. We want to be client friendly. What's your preference on how we would proceed?
Well, I think, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that we would prefer to submit additional information and a potential proposed resolution or request shaped along the lines that more or less that Commissioner Weintraub had outlined, if that's possible, and then have the commission defer consideration until that revision or clarification of the request, if you will, can be submitted.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub?
I just, full disclosure, right? I want to, you know, I don't want you to go off and do something under a misunderstanding of where I am on this. I think what I potentially could support would be a much more specific and narrow request. The statute talks about advisory opinions with respect to a specific transaction or activity, and then obviously other people who want to do the same thing can take can follow the same advice. So, you know, if you're if what you want is guidance on how a principal campaign committee could fashion an ad that, you know, in what whether that might comply with the small items exemption. That's one request. You know, I'd want to see, have some indication of what, how the ad would read. If you want to know how a union might be able to fashion an ad that might comply with the small items exemption, because it would provide some mechanism for people to figure out that the message was coming from the union. It seems to me that's a separate request. You can combine them in, but it's, you know, because presumably it wouldn't be worded in exactly the same way coming from a third party as it would coming from a candidate. So what I'm looking for, in order to be able to give you some comfort and some help over here, is more specifics. And I would be most likely to be willing to adopt an advisory opinion that was about a very specific transaction, and least likely about something that asks about a broad category of.
We understand, but there, we may, we would want to probably clarify a request with respect to multiple categories, in the sense of authorized committees, other political committees, and non-political committees. And of course, it is commonplace to very specifically, but combined in the same request as a clarification of our initial request. Thank you, Commissioner.
Happy to consider it.
Any other comments? Without objection, then, the commission is going to defer and hold this matter over. I want to ask the general counsel's office, do we have any timing issues that we need to address here with Mr. Sandler while he's here?
Right. Right now, the extended deadline is January 31st. So unless the commission were confident that before the end of this month, it would be able to resolve whatever is put forward ultimately, I would say that we would need to request an extension from the requester.
Bear with me, Mr. Sandler. Let me tell you what the calendar is looking like. Give you an idea, because sure, we're probably going to be asking you for a little more time. I think you're going to want a little more time. And we have not approved this calendar yet, but we're looking at a February calendar where we will have meetings probably of February and potential open meeting the week of February the 3rd, either the 4th or the 6th, and then an open meeting on February 27th. Would you want to extend to the 28th to give us give you more time to submit additional materials and the commission time to have another hearing on it in NAC?
Yes, we're fine with that extension.
Okay,
we'll
confirm, we have an extension
to you.
Yield document that Mr. Knopp, thank you. Okay, gentlemen, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman. Item number 3 on our agenda today is a proposed interpretive rule regarding nationwide independent expenditures. We have late submitted documents on the submitted here today, and I want to let me see, Ms. Walter-Streicher.
Close. Waldstreicher.
Waldstreicher. Ms. Waldstreicher and Mr. Knopp, you're here today. Could you explain this for the commission?
Happy to. Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Goodwin. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 14-7 consists of 3 alternative drafts of an interpretive rule regarding reporting nationwide independent expenditures in presidential primary elections. All 3 drafts clarify the Commission's interpretation of statutory and regulatory reporting requirements as they apply to the reporting of independent expenditures that are made in connection with a presidential primary election, but that do not reference or target a specific state's primary. Draft A follows advisory opinion 2011-28, advising that for the purposes of determining whether and when the thresholds for filing 24 and 48-hour reports have been met, political committees should divide the total cost of an expenditure by the number of states that have not yet held the presidential primary, and they should report the portion of the expenditure that is attributable to each state's primary election as a separate expenditure.
Draft B advises that a political committee should use the first day of the candidate's nominating convention as the date of the primary election for the purposes of determining whether and when the applicable thresholds for 24-hour and 48-hour reports have been reached. Instead of reporting states where the expenditure was made, the committee should include a memo text entry indicating that it was a nationwide expenditure. And Draft C is similar to Draft B, but advises that a political committee should use the date of the next upcoming primary election for purposes of determining whether and when the 24 and 48-hour reporting thresholds have been reached. And if the commission approves any of these drafts, we request authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Thank you. We're not going to act on this matter today. This is a matter that the commission is considering, and we're going to invite public comment for a period of time. We'd like to get public reaction to this interpretive rule, and if anyone would like to speak to it today, you're welcome to, but we're not going to come to any conclusion today. Yes, Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to get into the substance of any of these. I just wanted to suggest to anyone who's out there and is thinking about commenting that it's not just a question of should we adopt Draft A, Draft B, or Draft C, but I think any of these are open to revision. I'm not sure any of them are perfect in their current iteration. Maybe we may decide that one of them is the best we can do, but I don't think any of them are perfect. So if people have suggestions for how to improve them, how to bridge differences, I personally would be grateful to have that that input. And I just wanted to mention that I am still contemplating for myself whether the notice of interpretive rule, whether putting out an interpretive rule or doing this through a rulemaking is the better course of action. So I'm just sort of still turning that one over. Is it our intention to publish this in the Federal Register, just put it on the website?
I'm sorry, counsel.
I think the website.
Website, Mr. Knopf?
Yes.
Okay. Website, Commissioner Weintraub, and do you want to propose a different treatment? I would seek counsel's advice.
If we put it in the Federal Register, it doesn't quite get you to a rulemaking, but it's a broader way of providing notice and comment opportunities. Maybe more people would be aware of it.
At least I would have to touch base with the Office of the Federal Register and make sure that it's even possible to put three different alternative interpretive rules out for comment. I mean, it doesn't fit in the category of an NPRM, and I'm not sure.
Okay.
And then maybe it can be done. I'm not foreclosing it, but I would at least like to touch base with them.
I recognize that the Federal Register has their own set of rules, and I have a mild preference for putting it in the Federal Register if it's possible to do so, but...
Ms. Waldstricker?
I just wanted to add, not only do we have to check whether they would accept alternative drafts of the rule, we have to check whether they accept, whether a notice of a draft interpretive rule is even a category that they recognize. They will publish an interpretive rule in its final form, and they'll publish a notice of a proposed rulemaking, but this, I'm not sure, fits into one of their categories, so we need to check that as well.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How have we done this in the past? We've done interpretive rules in the past. Have we just done these by website, or what's been kind of the...
Yes, I believe that's how we've done it before.
Okay, so that's kind of the normal right. course of how we've
done it. I think there's been often a crawl on the bottom of the web.
Right, and we could put it out with the weekly summary that that the press office puts together every week
right.
as well. So,
right.
And probably keep that in there during the duration of while this was pending. So
okay. We could tweet it, too.
That's right, we're...
And Ken and Dave will
we run banner
it,
ads on it as well.
I'm sorry, can I
yes,
add
ma'am.
Something? What we've done, the most recent, thank you, sorry.
I'm saying that for the record, I've been asked. I've been asked to announce names.
Sure. I think the most recent interpretive rule that that we worked on, we put it, the draft or drafts, I don't remember, on our website and it's seeking public comment. And then the intent was to put the final interpretive rule that was adopted, that was published in the Federal Register.
Okay.
So the seeking comment phase was through our website, and we did have a crawl at the bottom of the homepage, and then the final rule was to be published in the Federal Register.
Commissioner Weintraub, are you satisfied with that treatment? Or do you still want to investigate a Federal Register publication?
It's fine with me. I seem to recall that we once put one in the Federal Register, but maybe I'm just misremembering. But as I said, we can put it in the weekly digest, or as actually Commissioner Peterson said, we can put it in the weekly digest, we can tweet it, we can rely on our friends in the media to publicize it, and hopefully we'll get good comments.
Good. We encourage public comment on a difficult issue we've been struggling with internally. So, okay, we'll proceed to item four on the agenda, Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Dallas County Republican Party. DCRP, document A11-14. I'd ask the audit staff to come up. And I understand we have...
Oh!
Paula Nerthen and Doug Kodish?
Correct.
Okay. Ms. Nerthen and Mr. Kodish for the Audit Division, thank you. Yeah, you have the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon. I'm not quite sure which at this point. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Dallas County Republican Party, which recommends that you approve the two findings as presented in the draft final audit report. The two findings were finding one, misstatement of financial activity. The audit staff determined that for 2010, the committee understated its reported receipts and disbursements by $31,817 and $32,201, respectively. Finding two, for 2009 and 2010, the audit staff identified payments to employees totaling $35,520 for which payroll logs were not maintained. This amount consisted of $70,520 for which the committee allocated payroll between federal and non-federal activity, and $15,000 paid exclusively from the non-federal funds. We're prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions or comments of the audit staff? Vice Chair Ravel?
Thank you. This is not a question. Thank you very much for your presentation. I noticed that with respect to all of the four audits that are on the agenda today, there's an issue that has apparently come up previously with the commission, but it was prior to my being present on the commission, and I'd like to give my views on the issue. None of the audits identify the amount that the committees paid to contract workers, and the committees didn't maintain logs to document that the time that those contract workers spent on federal election activity. And it's my view, I think this is an important issue for us. I think that this amount should at least be reflected in the record-keeping finding, because to not require this, I think, opens up a loophole that is not and was not contemplated in BCRA, and we should be reflecting it in our audits. And so during each of the motions, I will be making a motion with respect to that. Thanks.
I have a quick. Could you go through those numbers one more time on the payroll, and just go through those numbers one more time that you said on the payroll issues?
The payroll was $85,520 for which payroll logs were not maintained. $70,520 of that was for payroll which was allocated between federal and non-federal funds.
Okay.
And $15,000 was for payroll that was paid exclusively by the non-federal bank.
When you say exclusively, do you mean to one employee who was exclusively paid from the state funds?
No, exclusively paid from the non-federal funds.
Non-federal bank account.
Non-federal bank account.
Okay. Were any employees paid exclusively from the non-federal account?
Yes.
Okay. So you had one or more employees who were paid 100% from the state account?
That's correct.
Okay. And do we have any information that those individuals who are paid 100% from the state account performed federal election activity?
No. We were told that they performed only non-federal activity.
And do we have any information to controvert that representation?
No.
Okay. Does the audit recommendation contemplate finding that they violated the law by failing to keep audit logs for that individual or individuals?
That's correct. That's what our audit finding was concerning, that they didn't maintain logs to show what percentage of time for any of these employees they split their time between federal and non-federal activities.
Well, I understand some split their time and were paid with a mix of federal and state funds.
Correct.
And they failed to keep audit logs for those individuals.
That's correct.
Okay. One or more individuals were paid exclusively with state funds, mm-hmm. right?
That's correct.
Okay. And their representation was that those individuals performed only state election activity.
That's correct.
And we have no information.
Non-federal activity.
Non-federal activity. And we have no information to controvert that representation.
That's correct also.
Okay. But encompassed in the audit recommendation is to require them to keep logs even for that non-federal employee?
Well, one of the issues, Mr. Chairman, is that, you know, we review non-federal activity to determine whether there's a federal election activity component to it. And so as we're reviewing that information, you know, we look for documentation. In this case, we didn't have any documentation to substantiate that there wasn't federal election activity.
And the burden is then on the state party to prove to you that the individual performed only non-federal activity?
In essence, yes, I guess you could say.
Sounds like a burden-shifting problem. Do we typically audit state parties in their activities regarding non-federal elections?
No, we don't.
Okay. Yeah. Where do you think we get the jurisdiction to regulate, i.e. by imposing a log requirement, on a party's completely non-federal election activity?
As I said, we rely on the records to support that there is no federal election activity going on in those accounts. And, you know, anything deeper than that, I would have to defer to the OGC to comment. Because that's a legal issue, I believe.
Well, I would ask our Office of General Counsel, do we have jurisdiction over non-federal election activity performed by the state party?
No, but in this instance, what the issue is getting at is that the regulation requires that... Oh, sorry.
In your name, please.
I'm sorry, Danita Albarico. But the regulation requires that all employees maintain records of their activity. And so even those employees who spend no time on federal election activity for purposes of audit determining whether the allocation is appropriate, regulation, we believe, supports that all employees, includes those employees who spend no time on federal election activity.
I guess for discussion purposes, I'm just going to object to that assertion of federal jurisdiction over a state party where we have no evidence to indicate that the person did anything other than non-federal activity. I don't believe that the commission has legal jurisdiction to regulate 100% non-federal activity by imposing reporting logs, our regulatory regime, unless we have explicit statutory authority, such as in the case of, foreign contributions or something like that, that prohibits foreign money in all elections. So in the future, I just want to let you know, unless we have information contravening the representation of the state party, I'm going to suggest when we see audit reports in the future that we don't have jurisdiction over 100% non-federal activity, whether it's an employee or whether it's an ad that the state party runs to elect their gubernatorial candidate, for example, that doesn't mention a federal candidate. And I'm going to probably support a motion today that excises that piece of the recommendation. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The position that you just articulated, as auditors know, is this came arose also in the Georgia FEC audit, and there was a motion in that. It didn't carry, but the position that you just articulated was one that that I supported as well as Commissioner Hunter and then Commissioner McGann. So I stand by the position that that I voted on back in that one, and at the appropriate time, I will support the same conclusion that we excise that amount that we. So in this case, Dallas County Republican Party support the recommendation with respect to the $70,520 in payroll expenses that were allocated between federal and non-federal funds, but excise the $15,000.
Any other comments or questions? Commissioner Walther.
This is a case where the state party registered, though, didn't it, as a federal political committee?
Correct.
So when they do that, they recognize that there's some aspect of their activity that may be governed by federal law, I assume.
I would assume so.
Okay. Then how much of a burden is it when you know you have employees A, B, C, D, and you know at least at the beginning of the activity that you intend to have it 100% state funding? And so the record keeping would mean that... as I understand it, you just report that it wouldn't be a burden because you just know that that's the way it's going to be. But at least you'd have a record of it. So I see an affirmative nod. I guess the question to me is: it's not really a burden; it's a record-keeping requirement. The entity is registered as a federal political committee. I don't see a jurisdictional aspect to it that prohibit us from asking, what the employees are doing. And to me, it's very often. At least in my experience, that things move fast during campaigns. What you plan at the very beginning doesn't always turn out to be the case because new things arise, new money comes in. So old employee A may, as you intend, go through half of a period that you're talking about or anticipating, and the next thing you know, A has to be doing some federal work too because somebody's sick, somebody has other things to do. And at that point, if you don't keep records or keep track of it, then you... have to commence it. So I'm just thinking from my own perspective that it's hard for me to eliminate that given the fact that it wouldn't be much burden. You've got a federal political committee. Things can change during a campaign, which would require change and alteration of record keeping, and it would be hard to look back. So those are some of the factors that run through my mind. I welcome any comment on that.
Yes,
well,
sir.
I think, the position is that there could be federal, it's always that there could be federal election activity in the non-federal account, and that's why it is examined. Mm-hmm. And, with the lack of records, and, we had some OGC device that there was that they felt that there was a payroll record-keeping requirement, so that's, why it ended up in the report.
Mm-hmm. Well, in response, Commissioner Walther, I think it is a burden. I think this audit establishes it's a burden. They had to address this audit. They had their state account audited. They're now being dinged in a recommendation of an audit report. It could be, depending on the dollar amounts, it could be referred to OGC for further enforcement. So I think that the second you start asserting the jurisdiction over non-federal activity, you are imposing great burden and potential burden and even punishment. I do not think that we have jurisdiction over purely state election activity. So if a state party decides to run advertisements to elect or defeat gubernatorial candidates in a race, and we have no evidence that that advertisement mentioned a federal candidate, we don't have jurisdiction to regulate that expenditure of state money from a state fund on a state election. And by the same token, I don't think we have jurisdiction to regulate an expenditure by a state party from a state fund on state employees devoting their resources and time to state elections. Now, in many state parties, it is quite practical to silo employees. in a given election year, you may have a Senate election, a congressional election, state gubernatorial election, and state delegate elections. And sometimes you assign your staff and say, your job is to get our delegates elected, or you're going to be working on the gubernatorial effort this year. So for a state party to make the representation, I believe the representation takes them out of our jurisdiction unless and until we find that they made a misrepresentation, that the employee indeed was engaged in federal election activity. So I think that the jurisdictional fork in the road is quite significant. Commissioner Weintraub.
If we don't require them to keep any logs and we don't look at anything that they say at the get-go is non-federal, how would we ever know? How would we ever require the information that they were just wrong?
Well, in this case, they do have employees that they admitted engaged in federal and state activity, and they did split the funds. There is some evidence that they were aware of the split requirement and that they minded their P's and Q's in dividing the money between state and federal accounts for those employees. I think what your question presupposes is an intent just to violate the law.
No, not at all.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting any intent to violate the law. I'm suggesting more likely a complete inadvertent violation because the rules are complicated and they may have thought there are certain what might feel like non-federal activity, like get out the vote activity close to an election where a federal candidate's on the ballot. They might think all that's non-federal because their intent is to promote their gubernatorial candidate. But in fact, some of that is considered federal election activity. They just might be wrong.
We have, in this case, we have no evidence. They've been there. They've audited. They've looked for it. They find no evidence that this individual performed federal election activity. And absent that evidence, we don't have jurisdiction to impose a regulatory regime on that state employee any more than we can impose federal disclaimer requirements on their state election advertisements.
But as you said, we went and we looked. And if we have no – if we don't look – I mean, I get the argument that some people would say, well, you know, as long as they tell us they're doing it right, I mean, why do the audit at all? They told us they were doing it right. We should accept their word for it and just, you know, bother somebody else. That's one way of that we could do our business. We could just shut down the audit division altogether. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we I'm certainly willing to consider our audit thresholds and how we decide who to audit. You know, if we, you know, one of the things that struck me about this audit in particular was that, you know, we're looking at fairly small dollar activity here. And I kind of looked at that and said, if we're auditing this committee, maybe we ought to take another look at our audit thresholds and see if they need to be adjusted so that we're focusing our energies on major players and not small fry. Not to in any way demean the good folks of Dallas County. But that's a separate question altogether. If we are going to do an audit, I think the audit division, I believe, rightly has historically asked for logs from all employees. We recently refined that in the context of employees who are being paid entirely with federal funds. And what the commission said in that case was, well, yes, you're still required to keep the logs, but the commission's not going to penalize you since you've taken the made the choice to pay entirely with federal funds. And the whole purpose of the logs is to make sure that you're not underpaying with your federal funds. You're paying 100% with federal funds. That satisfies any interest that the Act would have in your record keeping. But this is a different aspect of that. This is where they're choosing not to use federal funds. And in order to assure ourselves that that decision is rightly made, I think we have to look at some records.
Well, I was told we did look, and we found no evidence countermanding the representation. So now the Federal Election Commission is nonetheless asserting its regulatory jurisdiction over purely state activity in an audit report that makes a finding of a violation of a reporting requirement where we have no evidence to indicate this individual engaged in any federal election activity. The audit finding now is the regulatory act in a case where we have no evidence that they engaged in any federal election activity. We are asserting jurisdiction into a purely state affair through the audit finding itself.
Well, the problem is that we don't know. The reason that we have no evidence, or we don't have any evidence that they did anything wrong, we also don't have any evidence they did anything right, we just don't know because they didn't keep the logs. And that's the whole point of this regulation and the way the auditors interpret it, is to make sure that logs are kept so we can assure ourselves that they are doing it right. If we don't look, if we say you don't have to keep the logs, then we are never going to have any information. Mm-hmm.
And the log is in a regulatory burden imposed on purely state activity, which I don't believe we can impose any more than we can impose disclaimers on state ads. I get the problem you're identifying. How do we know? Well, they made a representation. Our auditors went. Our auditors saw no information to countermand the representation. And now, even with armed with all that audit information, we're nonetheless asserting regulatory jurisdiction. So I don't think we can impose a federal requirement on purely state activity. And I've exhausted myself, but that's my position.
No, we're just going in circles.
Yes,
because
ma'am.
The reason that we don't have any information to either contradict or confirm that these employees were appropriately paid with non-federal funds is that they didn't keep the logs in the first place. So, you know, we're just going around in circles at this point. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to agree respectfully and decently and graciously to disagree on this point, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Could I clarify something that I said? I'd like to clarify that we didn't have any evidence to support what they said or oppose what they said.
Right.
And these employees that were paid from the non-federal account were also paid from the federal account, from the shared allocated portion.
That's a different, that's a different than I understood. I thought there were some employees who were in silos paid 100% with state money, mm-hmm. and the representation was that at least as to one or more of those employees, they kept no logs. I readily admit that if you have an employee who is paid jointly out of federal and state, and the representation is because they engaged in both, then there is a log requirement.
That's what was happening in this case. These employees that were paid from the non-federal were also paid from the shared federal-non-federal activity.
Okay. I agree, those employees, we have jurisdiction, and they should keep a log. Was there any employee in Dallas County paid 100% with state funds?
I would have to double check that there wasn't one. It's my recollection that there wasn't.
Bear with me one sec.
There was zero.
I know what he's asking. Is there any that were silent? Just out of the way.
I'm sorry. I see my point of confusion then. In the summary of your findings on page 5, there is a sentence that the amount of $85,520, this consisted of $70,520 for which DCRP allocated payroll between federal and non-federal funds, and $15,000 that DCRP paid exclusively with non-federal funds. And I interpreted that to mean that there was an employee behind those numbers, a siloed employee. And is that just not the case?
That's not the case.
Thank you for the clarification. Help me understand the verbiage. $15,000 that DCRP paid exclusively with non-federal funds. Explain how that $15,000 trickled through the payroll.
It was paid from non-federal bank accounts.
sprinkled across employees?
Sprinkled across, I believe, no more than two or three employees.
Who are also paid federal funds to engage in federal activity as well?
Correct.
Okay. Can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please do.
So was, because I think I'm confused also at this point. So the $70,520, was that paid out of an allocation account?
That's correct.
Okay, that's it. So there was an allocation account and a non-federal account, and they paid for part of it out of the allocation account and part of it out of the non-federal account.
Right. The allocation account is a federal bank account. Right.
Okay. And no siloed employees being paid exclusively with state funds?
I would have to double-check that there wasn't possibly one. To my recollection, they were all both paid out of a non-federal bank account and also at times paid out of the federal bank account.
Okay. I need a moment.
Thank you.
We'll take a 5-minute recess.
I wouldn't expect so much.
Okay, without objection, we're going to hold over item number 4 today, which is the audit of Dallas County Republican Party, and item number 5 today, which is the audit of the Republican Party of Iowa. This issue is embedded in both of those audits, and we just want a little more detail on the facts of how employees were paid and what whether they went month in, month out between allocated funds and state funds, or whether any employees were siloed solely as state employees. And we're going to proceed then to item number 6 on the agenda today. Item 6 is the Audit Division's recommendation memorandum. On the Vermont Democratic Party, VDP, document A11-12. And I understand that Ms. Burgess and Mr. Kodish will present this audit report.
Thank
Welcome.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Before you is the Audit Division recommendation memorandum on the Vermont Democratic Party. This memorandum presents one matter, which is record-keeping for employees. For 2009 and 2010, the audit staff identified allocated payments to the Vermont Democratic Party employees totaling $203,472, for which monthly payroll logs were not maintained. After the exit conference, the Vermont Democratic Party amended its reports to disclose payments to employees as 100% federal paid activity. And that's the only matter on this particular report.
Any comments or questions by any commissioner? No? Any motions?
I'll make a motion in A11-12, Vermont Democratic Party. I move approval for finding number 1, record keeping, as set forth in agenda document number 14-5, subject to an amendment to include the $630 paid to contract workers.
All right, we have a motion by Vice Chair Ravel. In A11-12 for finding 1 on record keeping as set forth in agenda document number 14-5, subject to an amendment to include the $630 paid to the contract workers. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No. No. That motion fails by a vote of 3-3. With Commissioners Weintraub, Walther, and Vice Chair Ravel voting in favor, and Commissioner Hunter, Commissioner Peterson, and myself voting a no. Or is there any other motion?
I just happen to have another motion. In A 11-12, Vermont Democratic Party. I move approval of the recommendations in agenda document 14-5, the Audit Division Recommendations Memorandum.
The motion before us in A11-12 is for approval of the recommendations in agenda document number 14-5, the Audit Division Recommendations Memorandum. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I did say aye.
Oh, okay. The vote is 6-0, with all commissioners voting in favor of the motion. And I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're now going to proceed to item number 7 on the agenda, which is discussion of the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Democratic Party of South Carolina and document number A11-19. We have a presentation again by Mrs. Northern and Mr. Kodish. Please give us our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Democratic Party of South Carolina, which recommends you approve two findings as presented in the draft final audit report. The two findings were record-keeping for employees. For 2009 and 2010, the audit staff identified payments to committee employees totaling $481,956 for which payroll logs were not maintained. This amount consisted of payroll that was allocated between federal and non-federal funds. Finding two, coordinated party expenditures. During audit fieldwork, the audit staff determined that the committee appeared to have exceeded the 2010 coordinated party expenditure limit on behalf of a House candidate by $5,117. Subsequent to audit fieldwork, the committee provided additional documentation and filed an amended report reclassifying one of the expenditures to line 30B, federal election activity. The audit staff concluded in the interim audit report and the draft final audit report that the committee did not make excessive coordinated expenditures.
Okay. Any comments or questions? None? Any motions?
I'll try it again. In A11-19, Democratic Party of South Carolina, I move approval for finding one, record keeping, as set forth in agenda document number 14-6, subject to an amendment to include the $11,920 which was paid to contract workers.
I could use this to repeat. Motion before us in A11-19, Democratic Party of South Carolina, is for approval for finding one on record keeping as set forth in agenda document number 14-6, subject to an amendment to include the $11,920 paid to contract workers. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails by a vote of 3-3, with Commissioners Weintraub, Walther, and Vice Chair Ravel voting yay, and Commissioner Hunter, Commissioner Peterson, and the Chair voting no. Another motion?
Another motion. I'm getting good at this. In A11-19, Democratic Party of South Carolina, I move approval of the recommendations in agenda document number 14.6, the Audit Division Recommendations Memorandum.
Okay, the motion before us in A11-19, Democratic Party of South Carolina, is for approval of the recommendations in agenda document number 14-6, the Audit Division Recommendations Memorandum. Any discussion or questions? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye, and the motion passes unanimously. Okay, we now move to item 8 on our agenda, which is approval of the meeting dates through September of 2014. We have a late submitted document that was approved by the commission. And are there any comments or questions on the calendar through September of 2014?
I have a comment.
Yes.
I want to commend you, Mr. Chair, for a yeoman-like job in working on this calendar and getting a reasonable calendar for all the commissioners going forward. Thank you.
I tried to avoid stepping on toes. I stepped on a few, and we'll do our best to ameliorate those impacts on everybody. I can tell you that so far that I've been chair, this is the hardest thing I've had to do is try to create a calendar. Are there any motions?
Yes. I move approval of the 2014 meeting dates as set forth in agenda document number 14-8, meeting dates for the months of February through September 2014.
Vice Chair has moved approval of the 2014 meeting dates as set forth in agenda document number 14-8, meeting dates for the months of February through September 2014. Any discussion or questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye, and the motion passes unanimously. Mr. Palmer's not with us. Ms. Orock, you're here today representing management of the building. Are there any management or and or administrative matters to discuss here today?
There are none.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.
Hey. Cut through that. Sorry, guys. A little rough in a few spots.
No. It's good.
I was just trying to do what Ellen did.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Blame me.
Yeah. Right.
We'll come back. Let's see. It is almost 12. Why don't we come back at 1:30?
Two
o'clock? We'll come back at 2 o'clock for an executive session. 2 o'clock.
I'll come back at 1:30. User friendly.